guys. How you doing? Classical Guitar Insider here. Your host, Brett Williams. Today on the show, Yuri Liberzon, the Israeli-born guitarist who now lives in the Bay Area. He lived in New York for a while. He's got a new CD out, Ascension. It's got Lennon McCartney, some Scarlatti, some Bach, even some Keith Jarrett on it. All these Lennon McCartneys were arranged by Toro Takemitsu, which I find outstanding. Anyway, the conversation has a lot of lulls in it. It's just the way it is. I don't really have time to edit it. I'm in the middle of some stuff. I hope you guys are okay with that. Usually I have time to fiddle around with it and stuff like that. I'm just trying to pump it out. You know it didn't come out this Friday. It didn't come out this Friday because I was busy with the Thanksgiving stuff. And just the social stuff kept on popping up. And I had to be a lot of places. And we had it at the apartment. Old Wendy is back. All right, she's back in the apartment. And she's been here for about 2 weeks now. We're trying to work it out. It feels very tentative, but it's also very loving. And, you know, we both love each other a lot and we want to make it work. And we're going to try and make it work in a way that's more sincere than it has been in the past, on my part especially. I'm not good at putting her happiness first, and that's something that I got to work on. So I'm trying to make it where I don't complain as much. You know, that's one thing I can do. I can complain and I can win arguments very quickly. And that's a gift. I thought it was a gift that I had. It ends up, it's not good to win an argument, because when you win an argument, someone else loses. So if you care about the happiness of your opponent, you won't argue with them. You know, and you won't try and tell them to change things about themselves. And that's something that, you know, that I have a hard time with. I'm a very, not aggressive, but I have opinions and I'm proactive. You know what I mean? Just like, you know, when my hand doesn't work, I compose music so that my hand will, you know, so I can play it. That's the way I am. I'm not, I'm not a quitter. And that ends up being off-putting. In a relationship, it ends up being something that's not always the best thing. So, you know, when I have a problem with something that she's doing, which she does things that she should not be doing. Okay. I no longer give her any shit about it. Not for the time being. And 2 weeks doesn't seem like that long, but it's a long time. It's a long time to be biting your tongue, watching stuff happen. You know, the only thing girls, I understand that us guys can appear angry, even when we're not angry. But one thing you could do for your old man this Christmas is maybe, you know, when he's trying to suppress, you know, his anger or his emotions, let's say, you try not to tease him. You know what I mean? That's the only thing that's getting to me. Is that I'm trying to be different. And the whole time she's sitting there going, oh, I can tell. I can tell you got that glint in your eye. I can tell you're angry. That, I mean, oh my God. It's like you can't win. You can't win. Once you've shown them, you know, your that masculine rage, it's always there. And it's never happened in a way that's destructive or, you know, things being thrown around the house or, you know, we aren't really that into screaming anymore. You know, we have been in the past when we were children. We used to scream at each other all the time in the beginning of the relationship. But now, you know, we try to keep it down. We try to keep it low. We try to keep it as respectful as possible, I guess. Who am I bullshitting? But the point is, it certainly has never been physically violent, but it's gotten, it's never violent. It's just, I'm me. I have big eyes and a big face. And, you know, when I'm upset, I have been told that it looks frightening by my students, by Wendy, by some of my friends. And it's something that people don't enjoy. And so I am completely turning that off. And I am treating her with just everything she does is great. Her happiness is my number one priority right now. And I got to tell you, it's working because we're not fighting as much. and not fighting is that's huge. The difference between a household that has fighting in it and a household that doesn't have fighting in it is night and day. And, you know, like I said, or like I may have not said yet, my friend Mike was the one that sort of, you know, put that little nugget in my head. It was just like, just put her happiness first for a while and see what happens. Huge difference. Is it the difference? Is it going to make the difference between me being in a relationship that I can be in and her being in a relationship that she can be in? I think it'll help her on her end. Now I just have to decide whether or not I can put up with the shit I have to put up with. And I think I can. Anyway, so that's where we're at with that. I appreciate all your thoughts and prayers. You know, thanks for listening to that. And, you know, I don't want to get too into, you know, her end of things, because I feel like that's private. That's something she can share with you on her podcast. She doesn't have one. But, you know, I can talk about what I have done wrong and what my responsibilities are. I feel like that's something that I could share with you. You know what I'm saying? All right. Anyway, another reason why I was busy. She made an outstanding turkey. We got my friend Matt LaRue from Taquiera Diana here in the city. He's a guy from back home. He's younger than me anyway, but our connection is we're both from Stockton. And he brined my turkey for 4 days, and it was outstanding. So we had it here. We had my brother and his new girlfriend over. And it was really something. It was a fun Thanksgiving. A lot of partying. But more or less pretty fun. Anyway, you know, that it's always great when you don't have to spend Thanksgiving with a family. You know, with the old folks. No offense to you guys. I love you very much. But, you know, Orphans Thanksgiving is the shit. If you ever get a chance to spend Thanksgiving away from your family, do it. It's the best holiday in the world. You get the football on, you got the food, you're all set. You don't have to sit there and talk to people that you have nothing in common with, except for a little bit of blood in the veins. Anyway, so that's what's going on there. In my case too, I always have to spend it with Wendy's family. And, you know, I get along really well with her sister. Her mom, you know, I love, but we have nothing in common. I mean, she just wants to talk about pie recipes for 20 minutes. It's exhausting. So I didn't have to do that this year. That's great. Anyway, the show is sponsored by SavageClassical.com. SavageClassical.com. You can go and you can get a guitar right now for 10% off all guitars for $3,000 and up. So you can get 10% off those guitars. If you get a $3,000 guitar, that's $300, right? That's a big deal. And those savings are going to occur for the rest of the, for 2 more days. All right. So you got 2 more days to cash in on that deal. That's SavageClassical.com, Bayshore, New York. Richard Sage is the guy. Ask for him or Chris Gotzenberg and tell him that Big Diaper Brett sent you. 10% off all guitars over $3,000 at Savage Classical right now. All right. Go there. Let's do it. All right. And then the other thing I need to tell you about is the fact that I have a show coming up. You don't have to come, but if you are looking for, you know, like a concert that's going to be in a little hall, you know, and that's not going to be in a venue, like a nightclubby venue, like the ones I enjoy playing in a lot. This is it. This is the Liederkranz Foundation on 687th Street, East 87th Street. That's 6 East 87th Street, New York, New York, 10128, 2 blocks from where I used to live and an hour and a half from where I live now. All right, so that's the other reason I was real busy and this didn't come out on Friday. This is now coming out on, I guess, Tuesday it's going to be up. All right, but you can go to the Liederkranz Foundation for more information or my website, brettwilliamsmusic.com, to donate and to go to the show. I believe the show will be for free. If it's not, hey, I'm sorry. Turn around and leave. But I'm pretty sure it's for free. It's being sponsored by the New York University Journalism Department, and they do a concert every year. And I know the head of that department is my singer friend's mom. All right. So that's how that happened. That's always how these concerts happen. You want to ask, everybody asks, oh, well, how does it happen? It happens by getting out there and being social. That's how you get your shows. It's the only way. Anyway, so that's going to happen. Again, that's 7 o'clock this Friday, December 4th. 7 o'clock this Friday, December 4th. Leader Crowns Foundation, 6 East 87th Street. All right. Come on by. It's going to be a great little show. It's got to be about a 50-minute show, so it's not going to be too long. And the reason is they just, that's how long they have the hall for. All right. If you can't make it to that, we're going to play again in January probably, but it's going to be tickets. And that's when I'm really going to need you to come. But this is good. If you're looking for a hall and you're looking for a Friday night show, you're looking for something to do this weekend, do it up. That's going on. This Friday, December 4th, 7 o'clock in the Upper East Side. BrettWilliamsMusic.com for more details. All right, guys. Well, that's about it for this week. I'm going to, you know, try to get this out to you. So I'm going to stop doing the intro and we'll pick up the dialogue next time. Thanks a lot. And here is Yuri Liberzon. So you felt, I mean, but your parents made the move just to get back to what? To a homeland? To be more connected with Judaism or what?
My parents are not religious. They're very secular. My mom is a doctor. My dad is an engineer. Mm-hmm. I guess in search for a better life.
Yeah.
But I have to say that they were not very happy with their choice, actually. I think if they were given another choice, I'm not sure they would actually move again. Move.
Right. They weren't happy in Israel.
Yeah, Israel is quite a difficult place, as we all know,
right.
with all the things that are going on. And
and those difficulties played a role in their personal difficulties? Like there was actually, did you move into like a war-torn area or one of the settlements? Or
No, we lived near Tel Aviv, like in a little suburb of Tel Aviv.
Okay.
So we were not really affected by any of the...
bombings or
any of the military actions, but still you read it in the news, there were buses that were exploding, and it was just very stressful, and just besides that, it's a very difficult country to make a living because most of the money goes to the military, and it's a small country, so there is not much opportunity, especially for myself, for music.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I had when I had another Israeli person on. She had said that there just wasn't enough opportunity. There's just not enough space. It's just very small place.
Even if you're a performer, there's not much audience. It's just a small place.
Right.
Like versus the U.S. For example,
all the music that comes out of there is pretty mind-blowing, though. You know,
there are a lot of great things that are coming out from there. Music and innovation and tech stuff.
Yeah. And so eventually, and your parents were both, you said, engineers?
No, my mom is a doctor.
Okay.
And my dad is an engineer.
Oh, your dad's an engineer. And engineers, I have said this before, seem to have guitarists for offspring all too often. It seems like my parents are not engineers. My dad sold socks.
He could be an engineer.
He could. And deep down inside, there's some sort of thing going on there, which sucks because who knows what he could have been, but he got into the sales thing. And then it's ridiculous how once you're stuck in a racket, you're stuck in it. You can't get out of it after a certain age.
I agree. Like, I can't get out. I can't stop playing the guitar.
Well, I can't. I can't either. I just don't have a resume for anything else. I actually started about a couple of weeks ago to try and just get a different job. And it just turns out that I don't. I have a teaching resume. I am a guitar teacher, essentially. Like a performer. I mean, we're all performers. But, you know, that's very piecemeal. And the money isn't really there. So basically, we're all these guitar teachers, and we built up this huge resume. And I know that we like to say that we don't, you know.
And you know, I have to add to that. The funniest thing is that most of us, when we go to school, we don't go to school to become teachers as guitarists. We go to become performers, and just had to add that. But there's only that much room for top players. I mean, so we all have to do different things, and sometimes it's difficult to simply be a performer, so we have to supplement.
The income. And I was just looking around for a different way of doing it, whether, you know, bartending or whatever, but even bartending, I couldn't get. I was like, okay, well, I bartended 15 years ago. They're like, no, we need someone with a lot of experience. And I'm like, come on now. You know, bartending, no offense to the bartenders out there, but it is the job that you do when you don't really, you're just kind of figuring things out or you're in between things or whatever. I mean, you know, there are really serious professional bartenders, but I, you know, so it's really difficult to, fantasize. I always fantasize about moving on to a different job, but really, you know, people just aren't interested.
Yeah. Well, it's a really...
We'd like to say we're not interested, but they're the ones that
aren't interested. Very strange time we live in. I mean, there are conservatories are still pumping out students every year. And
yet,
I find that a lot of them simply don't do music anymore.
No.
So there's just no market for it.
There's no market for it. It's basically a sort of a holistic education that is supposed to equip you with... tools to tackle other things. I don't know what it is, but it seems like there's just not enough jobs for us out there. I mean, from any standpoint, whether it's concerts, you know.
And unfortunately, education is not free here. So a lot of people have to deal with loans.
I haven't touched my debt. It's still there. Just flat 70, just sitting there, just paying the interest every month. But you went to a bunch of school, you know, I read that you also got some full scholarships to them. So you did your undergraduate at Yale with Ben Verdery, is that right?
Actually, I did master's at Yale.
So your undergraduate was over in Israel?
No, it was a Peabody.
Oh, okay.
I went to Peabody.
Oh, I got it mixed up.
I spent 5 years there.
Before getting to that, now, as far as starting out the guitar, I'm assuming that happened in Tel Aviv.
No, in Russia, actually.
It happened in Russia?
Yeah, I was 6 years old.
Oh, you're just a little baby guy.
But I still am. <Just kidding. laughs>
How are the Siberian... How is the faculty up there in Siberia?
You know, well... how should I say this? Siberia is a huge place, first of all. And Novosibirsk is a very advanced... Actually, one of the very advanced cities in Russia. Yeah. After Moscow and many other...
Oh, I had no idea. So it's called Novosibirsk,
which means New Siberia.
Novosibirsk.
Yeah.
Sibirsk.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, Sibirsk. Novosibirsk.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I got it. So it's New Siberia. New Siberia, you know, a metropolis, right? Like Austin is to Texas.
I mean, there's a lot of science going on there, actually. Okay. There is a whole city that is just dedicated to science.
Right.
And a lot of great musicians came out. Like, for example, Maxim Vengerov.
Yeah.
Famous violinist. He's Absolutely. From Novosibirsk.
Yeah.
Like Vladimir Gorbachev.
He's
from Novosibirsk. Konstantin Vasiliev, the composer, he's from near there.
Okay, so you guys are really pumping it out, though. Now, what made you not... Were you ever tempted to go the scientific route? Were you good at science as a kid? Were you good at math?
I actually went to a school that was... The focus was in sciences for a couple of years. And then I went to a different school that also had sciences and music department.
Yeah.
I like science. I mean, I really like technology. I like breaking things down, understanding how they work. Mm-hmm. But I found that for me, it was lacking something I was getting out of music, and that is expression and a bit freedom, and actually not being judged so much for, let's say, when you compare yourself, like in a let's say comparing grades with other kids.
Yeah.
You know, I found myself that was kind of devastating. It was hard for me if I wasn't doing as well as, let's say, some other kids. But for some reason, in music, I always felt that people were saying good things about my playing. I felt confident. I was motivated to continue improving. So eventually, I moved to that other school. And I realized this is what I really love doing.
Right. Yeah, so that was the thing. I mean, you think that deep down inside, there was something going on when you were little that was saying, like, well, I'm not really the best student in my science class, but I am the best guitar player in the whole school. Which is always, I mean, a lot of us are basically, we are the best guitar players from our high school. Like that.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Right, which is pretty fascinating because, you know, I went to a pretty big high school and there were other guitarists. And there was another guy there named Jason Branyon who was really good, but he was a little older than me. But other than that, yeah, I was the best. And it's like, it's weird that that kind of psychological what that can do to you, you know, because I wasn't a very good student either and I would get bad grades, but there was this one thing that I could do very well and nobody else could really.
Yeah. Well, for me, I have to say, as much as I would like to attribute it to myself, I have to give credit to my teacher.
Okay.
Who really inspired me and who really showed me, what a guitar can do. And, I would have these four hour lessons with him.
Right.
And I just really enjoyed practicing. For some reason, at that age, I really found out that I really enjoy improving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, basically you felt like you liked the incremental, the improvement. And that's something, there's something to say for that too. Like when I give a rock lesson, I always caution the parents who think that that's going to be the answer to everything. Like the kid doesn't want to practice. If I just teach him rock, it's going to be awesome. He's going to be happy. They're going to have a use for that $300 guitar that they bought. But really it never ends up that way because the graded course that I use an FJH beginner guitar method. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about? It's a rectangle.
I think I've heard
it's about like 30 pages each. They're very small. Mm-hmm. You know, which is really great because it gives a student a sense of accomplishment. Mm-hmm. They finish a book not in 2 years, like if they started playing an Aaron Shear book or a, you know, Frederick Node, they finish it in a semester and they go like, oh man, like it's, so it's that sense of accomplishment. And then the graded literature where they're able to like, you turn the colors change when you move on to a next thing. And even for the older kids, even for kids that are 10 or 11, it seems to work better than just sort of giving them the rock, which is going to have an F chord in it. And then we got to figure out what to do about that. So I think it is very attractive. I didn't really go through that when I was a kid. I didn't really learn classical till I was much older. But I would imagine that it would be very gratifying to have those books and to be able to get through those and be able to kind of like, you know, put those back in the shelf.
Yeah, of course. unfortunately, I didn't have that graded system when I was learning.
What'd they throw at you?
Various pieces, and my first teacher in Israel after I moved gave me some pieces that were beyond my ability.
Uh-huh.
So I remember I was playing Asturias when I was 12 years old, and I thought, now looking back at it, I think it was a bad idea. I don't think anyone should be playing Asturias when they're 12 years old, simply because of the left hand pressure. So when you practice the piece, right, if you don't know how to keep your hand relaxed, you may injure yourself.
Yeah, all those bars and all that
stuff
going on. All
those bars, and especially if your guitar is not set up properly, and most of guitars are not set up properly. Ones I had, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, your $400 guitar is probably not going to be able to,
withstand
the devastation of those left-hand bars.
But that, I had that teacher for a year. He was great in his way of showing me what a guitar can do and inspiring me to continue playing.
Yeah.
And even though I was struggling playing Asturias, I still think I enjoyed it very much. And people who heard me play also
were blown away.
Yeah. And I mean, we all know it's a difficult piece to play really well.
I think it is. Yeah.
But
for anybody.
But just to,
unless you're playing it on every program for 5 years,
you know, it's impressive how it sounds on the guitar.
Yeah, I should have never. I stopped playing that piece. I don't think I should have ever stopped playing that.
You know, it's funny. I actually put it back into my program, and I just played it on this tour.
I noticed. Well, your program actually is pretty interesting because you've got. I should say, you said your manager, your publicist, Michelle. Mm-hmm. Are you dating Michelle?
Possibly.
We all are. All of our managers are
well, this is the best kind of manager, right?
Good tell.
Who has your interest. Yeah.
I could tell just by her picture. I was like, because, well, the way that I, and I haven't even talked about this on the show, but I think she and I joined GrammyPro.com at the same time.
Oh, wow. Without talking to each other? It was just a coincidence.
It was just a coincidence, just a coinky dink there. And I, you know, the first thing I did when I reached out, because mine's up this year, and I'm assuming is this up for this is up too then.
Yeah.
So you submitted to the ballot for this, and this is on the ballot.
Yes. Did you say you submitted yours too?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
But mine wasn't a solo, so we're not in competition with each other. This is best.
There are many
solo
categories.
This is best solo performance, I'm assuming.
I think so.
That's all that Michelle knows. Well, is this a solo guitar album?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So I was up for best classical composition, and I'm up for best small chamber music performance, which this I don't think I have a shot at either of them, but, you know, we'll see. But as far as, so that's how I met her, was through there, which was very strange because we have so much in common. You know, you lived in New York. You studied with Ben. I studied with Fred Hand. So, you know, but the fact of it is, you know, yeah, so you've been submitted now, and this is is this the first time that you've tried to do
this?
Yes,
first time.
Now, how did she get involved? Because from what I understand, is she a musician too?
She used to play some guitar, but she's actually not a musician. I mean, not actively pursuing music.
Yeah. Right. So how was she able to submit? Do you have any idea about that?
I think...
because you have to have a certain amount of credits, or maybe there's some sort of manager
loophole. I think she qualified. I don't know for sure that she did qualify. The requirements were.
Right, yeah. It was like a big thing. So let's just talk about what you got going on here. I guess the original point that I was going to make is that there was a video of you playing on that site that sort of grabbed my attention. I was like, oh, this is great. I'll maybe invite him on. But that was original pieces, or were those pieces by, you know, I see you got Sergey Rudnev, the video that was submitted on there. Do you know that video at all? Or?
Yes, I played on that. Yes.
Was it the old Lime Tree? Or yes. No, actually it was a sort of you talking about music and what it meant to you.
Well, but in the background, probably I have that piece.
The old Lime Tree.
The old Lime Tree.
Which is what I thought, that's what I found on YouTube that I really enjoyed. So let's talk about that piece right there, the old Lime Tree. What's your relationship with Sergey?
Sergey, yes.
Sergey.
As Russian as it gets.
There it is.
Rudnev. Well, my relationship with it quite simple. I heard the piece. Actually, the first person who I think recorded it, I'm not sure if he was the first one, but he made it kind of well known. Was Vladimir Mikulka from I think he's from Romania or one of those Eastern European countries.
It's a big piece, 7-minute piece.
Yeah, and I think he played it before it was even published. And I still remember the cassette tape that I had it on.
Yeah.
I still have it. And
it's a cassette tape.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
And years later, I found the score. It was published by Matanya Ofi, the publisher, famous publisher.
Mm.
I think he's from Ohio.
I don't know that stuff.
Anyway. Yeah, and then I got the score, and I quickly learned it because I kind of knew how it goes.
Cool.
Even though it's a really difficult piece, and
right.
I felt really connected with it. I thought it represented me well. It shows a variety of techniques. It especially appeals well to non-guitarists.
Yeah, it's a beautiful piece in that sense. It's very lush. It's very harmonic. It's tonal, which is always good. You know, it's sort of nice when things are that way. As far as you know, the other but you have no relationship directly with Sergey.
No, I don't know him personally.
Oh, it's a her.
It's a him.
Oh, it's a him.
I don't know him personally.
Oh, you don't know him personally. And then what about? So I'm just going actually through the CD. The Danza Lukumi. Lukumi. Yes.
Uh huh. This is actually a piece arranged by Manuel Barueco, my former teacher.
Yeah.
And he arranged three of those Cuban dances. And this is simply a beautiful piece. And I'm not sure why, but, well, actually, I don't know the details, but or much about it, much about the connection between Cuba and Russia. What I find is Russians love Cuban music.
Really?
I think there was a time when a lot of Cuban music was popular in Russia.
Right.
So somehow, maybe me growing up, it spoke to me. Like, I had a connection with Cuban music.
Yeah.
And especially those three pieces are wonderfully arranged. And I've been playing for quite some time, usually for encores.
Oh, you mean the three pieces? So
well,
the dance
I only recorded one. I only recorded Danza Lukumi. There is La Comparsa and Alla Antigua. But
Now, let's talk about your time with Barueco. What do you think? You know, I don't know if I've had anybody on the show. There's been about 7 guests. I don't know if anybody studied with him that's been on my show.
No, I thought he taught a lot of people.
I thought he did, too. And, yeah, he's definitely one of the big teachers in the on the planet. But yeah, I don't think anybody I have had in here, or at least I haven't had a big conversation about it, or, you know, how was studying with him? We're talking about you did your undergrad.
I did undergrad and GPD, which is Graduate Performance Diploma. So
okay.
That's another.
You went afterwards thing. Back.
Yeah. Well, I didn't leave. I stayed.
Oh, you stayed. Okay.
Yeah. And then after that, I went for master's.
Okay. So you went master's with Ben.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like studying with Barueco? What made you decide to study with him?
Well, let me give you a little story here how everything started.
Yeah.
So I was in Israel going to high school. I was 17 years old, about to finish high school, mm-hmm. studying with my private teacher, Yaron Hasson, for 6 years. And during one of our lessons... my teacher decides to play a recording. And he actually, it was pretty common that he did that. He would play a recording and kind of ask me, who do you think it is? Because usually I could guess pretty well.
Okay.
And for the first time, I was like, I really don't know. It's
yeah.
too perfect. It just sounds amazing. I have no idea. I don't know such a guitarist. And obviously my next question was, it you?
Good idea.
Right. Well, because most of the time it was him.
Right. Oh, really?
Yeah.
So he was just like, who do you think this is?
So then he said, well, it's Manuel Barueco. Okay. Then I believe I went to Tower Records, a store in Tel Aviv.
Sure.
Right by the Mediterranean.
It's amazing. They had that out there, and now it's completely gone.
So then I bought a few CDs. Mm. Of his, and I listened to them, and I had a very unusual reaction to his playing. I thought, it doesn't sound like any other guitarist. There is something different about it. It's just levels above everything else I've heard. So I was really moved by it.
You're moved by the technical grace?
Not just.
Or did you hear an emotional depth?
I think there is more than these two definitions, to me.
Yeah.
I was moved simply by it, by what I heard. I don't know the specifics. I mean,
you just know.
I definitely
that you
heard it was on a very high level, and it was definitely something I couldn't do, and I definitely thought this is something I want.
Yeah, like the Vox box.
Yes,
did you have that?
I didn't hear. No, that was not the first CD that I heard. I heard the 998, the BWV 998 by Bach.
Sure.
And then it also has Hevise, which I actually ended up learning.
So you just heard like a one CD, one shot with
saying. So then I just got internet at home, and I sent an email to Manuel. His manager replied to me and connected me later with Manuel, and I sent some recordings to Manuel to listen. So I had to make a video recording, and he said some good things, and he said, well, you should apply to Peabody at Johns Hopkins, where I teach. I said, okay. I mean, I was just about to go to the army. Mm-hmm. It's mandatory in Israel for 3 years.
Yeah, yeah.
So, so it was perfect timing. And somehow, luckily, I didn't have to go to the army.
Okay.
It worked out.
Yeah, how does that work? I thought everybody had to go to the army.
Well, that is true, except when you...
study.
No, except when I had to tell them that if I don't practice a decent amount of hours a day, I won't be very happy. And they don't really want to have people who are not happy.
Oh,
you
really?
Know, well,
yeah.
You know, it was a 50-50 chance. So, and it worked.
Oh, you mean you saying that it wouldn't make you happy was a 50-50 chance?
No, no, no. 50-50 chance is them not caring about that.
Yeah. And so you just lucked out. You were just like, well, if I don't get to practice, I'm not going to be happy.
Well, what ended up happening...
Are other people happy to be in the Army? I guess it'd be kind of fun, kind of summer campish. There's girls and boys.
I can only speak for myself. Well, somehow they let me go. They let me. I don't have to go to the army, even though, you know, I can't say that I didn't really want to go. I think it would have been a good thing, yeah, for me, actually.
How so?
You know, having a different experience, becoming a man, you know, going, yeah, to the army, as opposed to just being a guitarist who practices his whole day.
Yeah, right.
It makes you into a man, you know, basically.
Right.
So I was ready to go that route, but what ended up happening is I got accepted to Peabody. Mm-hmm. And
they let you go. They excused you from your duty.
Well, they told me, what do you want? Do you want your case to be reviewed in a year, or do you want us to just let you go? And I said, well, let's have it reviewed in a year. And guess what? They told me I don't have to do it at all.
Wow. Right.
So somehow, I don't know, it's... psychologically, I was able to get what I wanted.
Yeah, exactly. That's really interesting, because I don't think it is mandatory.
It is, yeah. Yeah.
It is mandatory. But they must have like a heart about it.
Yeah, so then I...
Like you said, they don't want unhappy people, really.
Well, I think I think every year maybe there's a different quota,
mm-hmm,
and they probably met that quota already.
Yeah.
I don't know. I really don't know the inner workings.
Mm-hmm. So, well, maybe they just knew you wouldn't be like the best soldier. This guy who's
I had asthma, so I couldn't be running.
Oh, okay. So you were like, well, I'm going to be sitting a lot,
right,
and I'll be unhappy as well. They're like, you know what? We're going to go with Aharon over here, or whatever.
I got a letter from Peabody,
yeah,
saying that it costs like... forgot, I think it was like $30,000 a year back then.
Yep, and that was what it was back then.
And we didn't have that kind of money, so without much thinking, I wrote a letter saying, well, thank you very much. I appreciate, you know, everything you've done, but I can't come. So then...
That's heartbreaking. I went through that, too.
It was hard, yeah. It was hard, but, you know, there is not much I could do, and... I didn't really speak any English. I didn't know who to talk to about this.
Right.
There was this organization called American Israel Cultural Foundation, which I've been a winner of many times in Israel, but they don't provide that kind of support, kind of money. So then I told them, thank you, I can't come. And then 2 weeks later, I got a letter from them saying, well, come for free. We'll give you a full scholarship.
So you must have played really well.
Well, it was a combination of things. You know, it was what I learned at Peabody. They don't do that anymore. That year, I'm not sure what happened. I got a full scholarship. I don't know why. Maybe I did play well. Maybe I didn't. I don't know. I just tried my best.
Yeah. And the money was there.
And the money.
They must have had something that happened. Yeah, because it is a year-by-year thing. It's what people don't understand.
Right, right, right.
Every year it's a little different. Unless you go to, I guess, Juilliard, which is I guess they pay for people. Is that what's going on there?
I think it's free. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now Yale is free too.
Yeah, Yale is free too.
So yeah, that was amazing.
Which is mind-blowing.
It was mind-blowing, but especially mind-blowing for a person who comes from a different country.
Yeah.
And I remember I came during the summer with my mom. Well, she wanted to make sure everything is, you know,
sure,
set up properly. And I show up at Peabody, and they put me in a dorm.
Yeah.
And it's a dorm for two people. And I was supposed to have a roommate from Korea who never showed up. So I have this huge dorm, dorm room to myself for a year.
Never showed up.
Never showed up. And they didn't fill it up. Didn't put anyone.
Students are where they are at that point. So you had your own place.
Yeah. So, it was getting a little cold. So I had to warm up the room with an iron. I would just plug it in, put it in the middle of the room, and raise the temperature one or 2 degrees.
With an iron.
With an iron. Yeah. Well, I had to be creative.
I used to just use the stove in my apartment in Austin. I just leave the stove open.
I didn't have a stove. I had to work with what I had.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was amazing, I have to say. Like, and then... I mean, I knew.
Don't leave the stove open, people. College kids. It's a bad idea. It's stupid. I'm stupid. Go ahead. So you were in that dorm.
And then I started taking some classes and having my private lessons with Manuel. And I started to realize how special he is, how successful he is, how amazing his playing is even more when I got there. And on top of that, I was experiencing a culture shock, being in a different country. And I didn't really speak English, so I knew how to read and write, but it's a very different experience when you're immersed in a different
country. Now, how long ago was that?
2000.
Okay, so that's 2000. So you're about 34 years old, 35.
33.
You're 30, right? Okay. Still, my math is always a little odd. No engineers in my family, so the math comes and goes. So go ahead. So you felt at that point you were like you. Now you're at a new level of appreciation besides just listening. And like I brought up that Vox box because, and I brought it up on the show before, how that was like a pretty important collection of music for me and for a lot of people.
Yeah, I
like
think
just the amount of music being played at that level, it was cheap. You could get it back then, $18, which now is very expensive for a recording, but back then was a real steal for like whatever it was. I think it was like four discs.
Three. I think it's three.
Yeah, three. Everything played stellar, just like, you know, a textbook.
Yeah, I remember reading that even John Williams had very high praise about the recording. Because John Williams was probably the only other guitarist that at the time who was who played at that kind of level.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say when you were saying that. Like, I would have just guessed, if I didn't know who Manuel Barueco was, I would have guessed John Williams. Those are the two, I guess. I wasn't really aware of David Russell as a child.
I think he came later, maybe a little bit later.
Yeah, he's a little bit younger. And then, you know, like I was asking before, what do you feel you got from him?
I think...
What was his approach to teaching?
I have to say I have a huge influence from him on my playing.
Yeah.
On how I listen to music. Things like I'd always strive for technical proficiency, for accuracy.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, the biggest thing probably is the idea of serving the music as opposed to changing the music to fit me.
Right.
So,
letting the music speak through you.
Right. I always want to first identify, like, let the piece speak to me, see what it has to offer first before I start to cover it with my personality, with my ideas.
Yeah.
So I try to have the piece come through me to not lose that content. So I learned that from
that's
him.
That's definitely his approach, it seems like. Right.
And for some, it may seem they may criticize it as being cold or not expressive. I think it's just a different way of looking at music. And I have to say that he's not the only one who does that. Maybe in the guitar, I don't know. But in other instruments, there are lots of examples. Lots of musicians who do that.
Yeah.
Like, I can list a lot. Well, Rubinstein probably would be a little extreme, but he was extremely expressive. But when he didn't show any expressions on his face when he played, people thought he was just cold. A lot of people attribute some kind of physical expression to expression in their playing, in the music.
Right.
But I don't. I think sometimes it can be distracting. I think energy can be wasted on or spent on an emotion and something that's not really helping the music.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not really focused energy.
Yeah.
It's
a defensive mechanism is what I've called it. And I do it too. And I'm not saying that that's what is always happening. And I do enjoy when people move.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like that. I prefer that to people not moving. But I can understand how you're saying it can either be distracting to you as a performer to have to move around or to have to, you know, it creates tension. And I think it just basically insulates you from really having to reconcile what the music's actually saying.
You know, and the thing is, it doesn't have to. Like, I recently saw Yamashita play.
Okay, yeah, he's back.
And he moves a lot. But but it's different. I thought some of his movements actually helped the music. It helped the expression. Not always, but at least some of the time.
Well, there's healthy movement, and then there's just that expression of tension.
Oh, what I think I'm talking more is facial expressions.
Facial expressions are something that need to, be kind of honed in. Nobody likes to see somebody make it a bunch of faces.
Well, I don't know. Some people do. Some people attribute that to being musical.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But generally, that's the face thing is something that I struggled with when I was young. I used to do this. I see people doing that all the time, especially that sort of jowl tension, sort of making that almost frown face, that cartoonish, ugly frown face. Bream does it. I mean, people have these, you know, these things that happen, particularly when the mouth starts to get involved.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I go, like, because it is about what, you know, at some point you do have to say, well, what does the audience want to see? Does the audience want to see someone just sitting there doing this and not moving at all? Well, probably not.
Yeah.
But, when it starts getting into the mouth region, I can deal with eyes. I can deal with people doing... I don't have a problem with people using their eyes when they're thinking, because they are, like, thinking.
Yeah.
A thinking musician is, you know, there is a picture in his mind or a sound that he's going for. I mean, I expect the eyes to be manipulated, but the mouth needs to be left alone.
I guess I'm for as much awareness as possible about what you're doing when you're performing. I think when the more awareness you have, the more control you have of your act.
Yeah. Of your act.
Yeah. Performing act.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, no, you should, and that's the thing. So yeah, I had to rein that in, and that went away after. I just relaxed my face.
Well, there are ways to work on that. I mean, I'm sure I do a lot of things too, and but whenever I look at myself playing, you know, like a video, I'm like, oh, I don't want to see that.
Yeah, exactly.
I have to say, I've gotten a lot better, and because I've worked at it.
And then, so what made you head up to Yale then, after that?
You know, speaking of what I got out of Manuel,
I would like to, exactly.
There's a transition there. I think I started noticing I'm starting to really be highly influenced by his style, by his playing, and it's about time I should start looking for what I enjoy. You know, it's already been 5 years with Manuel, and I can definitely say that I could study with him for another 10 years easily.
Plenty of stuff to learn.
And never you know.
Was he able to articulate himself well as a teacher? Was he able to, I mean, not just share ideas through musical examples, but I would be, I don't know that much about him, but I assume he's not the most talkative guy in the world. And I've always wondered what people that don't talk very often, whether they can be a really effective teacher.
Well, he does talk.
He does talk. He talks a lot.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And he actually focuses most of his time on music.
I guess I'm thinking about his performances, because in his performances he doesn't really talk at all.
Well, it's an aesthetic. It's Yamashita, he doesn't talk at all as well. It's just a certain aesthetic, you know.
Right.
Some people want to connect with the performer on a personal level and to learn
more about
what they had for lunch, you know, earlier.
Yeah.
And some people just want to hear beautiful playing.
Yeah.
So it's just a personal choice. And I think for me, I'm kind of in between. I don't like to talk too much, but I also don't want to alienate audience that come and support me.
Right.
I think that's also important. Yeah.
It's fun to have a conversation with the audience.
Yeah.
But he was able to sort of, he was able to articulate himself well and to get his ideas across in an effective way. Yes.
Most of the time, yes. I think so, definitely.
So there were instances where...
Well, for example, I mean, it's just a very difficult concept of singing. How do you sing on an instrument? You're not actually singing. So one of the biggest things was singing with...
He would have you sing the melody while you played?
Well, definitely. But having a... asking yourself a question, what is it? When someone is musical, why is it musical? Why does it sound musical? Mm-hmm. Why is it? Like, is it just some kind of mysterious thing? Or is it... I think for Manuel, it's having a singing quality. So if you can sing a phrase, if it makes sense, if you don't do something abrupt, or if you don't break the flow of the phrase, because human voice, it takes an effort to go from a high note to low note, you know. It takes time for it to, for example, go from a high note to a low note, right?
Yeah.
You can't just, like, jump quickly.
Yeah.
So these are some of the considerations in phrasing.
Yeah, excellent. Yeah. And actually, that's what you're doing when you're walking down the street singing a song to yourself. That's where my ideas come from. Long walks through the park or whatnot, where I'm thinking about, I'm singing the song to myself, you know?
Well, and also when you sing it, you really connect with the melody. It changes its how you feel about it, how you interpret it. You know? It's a tool. Singing is a tool that we can use to work on our phrasing. So that was probably the biggest things that I've learned.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told about singing every single lesson.
Was he a technical teacher? Did he help you with the technique?
I think he only taught technique when he thought technique needed to be taught.
And so you weren't one of those students?
No, I was. I definitely was. I had to correct quite a few things. I worked on those things. No, definitely. And technique is not something you just have. You have to maintain it. You have to evolve. You have to...
Right.
Each piece requires a different technique. You know, there is always technical work.
Yeah.
But overall, I think he was more focused on the music.
Okay.
And on the performance aspect, you know, how to work on the stress, how to prepare. Actually, preparation, another big one. He would always say that if you practice a certain way, you will probably sound on the stage that similar way.
Yeah, know? That's something.
You know, so how you practice at home or in your practice room is very important.
Be aware of that.
Yeah.
You're not just going to get on stage and start making decisions.
Yeah, and also having an attitude of things happen for a reason. Like mistakes don't just happen. He would always trace back why that mistake happened. Is it because of the memory? Is it because...
you don't have command of that technique? Or
Or something hasn't been practiced well enough. And I mean, yes, there is an element of anxiety and stress while you play, of course.
Right.
But there are ways to work on that. For example, we have multiple kinds of memories.
Right.
Types of memories. We have visual, we have auditory, we have conscious, and I'm sure the list goes on. So there is also muscular memory, and we as musicians rely on muscular memory the most.
Mm-hmm.
So just because you played something a million times, it doesn't mean that you going on stage tomorrow performing, you won't make a mistake.
Right.
Because muscular memory is something that's affected first or the most when you are under stress. So if you put all your eggs into that basket, you most likely will make some mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what about visualizing the score? Why is that helpful? Because let's say you forget where your fingers go. Oh, now you can use that other type of memory to help you continue, you know, to kind of help you.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like a helicopter over a train.
Yeah.
Just security
thing. Right, yeah, yeah. Security is something that, yeah, we've talked about that before too. The security, the issue is being comfortable. And the more preparation that you've put into it from, you know, the different various angles from which you can prepare, whether it's visualization, whether it's muscle memory practice, whether it's small technical groupings, the more that you put into it, the more you're going to be able to relax, and then the more effective you're going to be able to play. Because it really is, the goal is to relax up there. Not even execute flawlessly, but the goal is to be relaxed and play however you can play. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't know. I mean, realistically, is it possible to be completely relaxed up there? I don't know. I don't think it's possible to be completely
relaxed.
No, but
the goal should be that you're comfortable. I mean, that's what
you don't want,
to
be uncomfortable. No. That's for sure.
You know, that's that for me at least. That's right there is the goal. I'm like, well, I play the way I play right now. I've had this piece for 6 months. I haven't had it for 2 years. I'm going to play this piece. It's going to be what it's going to be.
Yeah.
But at least up there, I'm going to calm down and enjoy this experience.
But you know, there's one more point. There are some players who go on stage and lose 50% of their ability.
Right.
And there are some players that lose 10%.
Right. But you're going to lose something.
Yes, but definitely. But what I think, I would rather lose 10% than 50%.
Yeah.
So how do you make that happen like that? So I think it adjusting how you practice and how, it's a mental training too.
Yeah. Exactly. And you know, like, what's interesting is, you know, I studied with Adam Holzman,
mm-hmm.
who, now that I think about it, I think he studied with Manuel, if I'm not mistaken.
I don't know.
He just with Aaron Shearer? I don't remember. But he was a Peabody guy. He did go to Peabody at some point.
Okay.
If I'm not mistaken. And the point is that still, like you said about the, you'll play like you play on stage. I've heard that from his lips. And the Aaron Shearer method is something that I think that you were obviously exposed to,
mm-hmm.
through Manuel.
Mm-hmm.
So coming from that sort of, from that viewpoint of the way things are, and that sort of, you know, dogged approach, you know, like going back and reevaluating your technique with easier pieces, for example.
Mm-hmm.
All of those sort of, I always think of them as like a Holzman sort of idea, just sort of like the very technical sound technique, very, you know, coming from things, approaching musicality in an analytic and organized way, going about it that way, and then you decided that you needed to figure out who you were and what made you, and then that, I mean, that's pretty much, I can imagine that Ben Verdery would be the perfect choice for that. Because I think a lot of people go to him. Same reason I went to Fred Hand was because Fred Hand wasn't going to, you know, kick the shit out of me about my scales or whatever. He was going to let me be me. And I know that Ben Verdery is the same way. He's not a technically, you know, amazing player. He's not a competition guy. He is a guy who is self-expressive. He's a composer. He is a guy who creates festivals. He's very creative, not only with his music, but with his career and about the way he approaches his students, you know, stuff like that. People dress up in costumes sometimes, I understand.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, Ben is a wonderful guy and
pretty much a polar opposite of
a Von Waco student. Yes, and it was a shock for me for sure.
We're talking about Yale people. If yes. You don't know what we're talking.
This is exactly what I was looking for, actually. Mm-hmm. Because I would also listen to what people would say about my playing, and many people would say, well, you're very careful when right. You play. You don't miss any notes, but there's more to the music. And I thought, okay, well...
And I don't mean to say Ben isn't a great player. He's just not one of those guys that... strikes me as a guy who can just sort of pick up a piece of music and play it super quick, yeah. Like a Bar Waco can, like a John Williams can, or something like that. There's more going on there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway.
I was very happy to study with Ben because
it was free.
It was free earlier too.
Right. I know.
It allowed me to. To seek for the music that I like, to be more expressive and to think more about what am I communicating other than just playing another piece by Bach, yeah. Like that was the time when I discovered a lot of Russian music, so I was starting to look for music that speaks to me. That
did he tell you to do that?
Oh, he encouraged that. Yeah,
he was like, look for something that other people haven't played.
Right. Yeah. Right. He also set an example himself. He would play arrangements of some popular stuff.
Yeah, he did like a Villa-Lobos thing not that long ago. Like I don't know. He was just playing all the Villa-Lobos.
Well, I'm talking more about the Prince.
Okay.
And Hendrix.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. Well, I don't quite personally. I don't quite go that way.
But, no, I don't like that stuff either.
But it just showed the little spectrum, the range of things you can do and that people actually enjoy hearing on the guitar.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Well, you have right here. You've got the Lennon McCartney.
Yeah.
Michelle.
Yeah.
Right there on the CD. So you took a cue from the old master up there at Yale.
Well, yes, but this kind of idea is actually more Manuel because he has a CD where he recorded Beatles.
That's true. The arrangement Toro Takamitsu.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, maybe I'm like the last person to understand that he made arrangements of Beatles songs, but he is the last composer that I would think would be
arranging 12 songs. That he 12 popular songs.
I would imagine
songs.
Roland Dean's doing it before I would imagine Toro Takamitsu doing it.
Yeah. Well, I guess
Toro Takamitsu, for those of you who don't know, writes very complex and avant-garde music for the guitar.
Well,
that doesn't seem to draw from popular music.
I find that in those Asian countries, sometimes the... popular music from the U.S. arrives there early. Well, I mean, later. Sorry, mm-hmm. And it becomes huge over there.
Yeah. But he's going into Ben Land. Well, first of all, yeah. So you did a couple of these too, because you have another one on there.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday.
I think you have something on YouTube where you're playing a different Beatles song.
Oh maybe with the orchestra. I'm playing some Brower.
Right. Right. Oh, Brower arranged them too. So you're doing the Beatles thing.
Oh, I think they're. I do what I find.
They are lovely beautiful. Too. I mean, those arrangements, those particular arrangements, are great because Beatles music does work on the guitar in a way that's palatable to me, at least a little bit, because the melodies are, they have those sort of major, sort of beautiful things, or if you do like Because or something like that, you've got these lush harmonies. Mm-hmm. Whereas doing, Prince, that doesn't make any sense to me. That's it, because that music is just not about that. It's about dancing and it's about backbeat. And that's it. It's supposed to be, and lyrics.
Yeah.
you know, are very important in a Prince song. So just to like just play popular music because it's popular is different. But, you know, having an arrangement of a Led Zeppelin song, like maybe Stairway to Heaven, obviously would be a clear winner.
You know, I have to say, I've been working on an arrangement of... Yeah.
Did I just deeply offend you?
No. No, not at all. I'm just using it to
make mention, a point.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be playing this song by Hozier. Hozier?
No.
Oh my God. Who's okay, that? Okay. Well, Take Me to Church. Have you heard that song?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's
dun, 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 dun,
yeah. But there you go.
Okay.
That song, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, I'll have to listen to it. It's not something I would particularly choose.
Well, but I give it a try. Yeah.
Jing, 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 jing. I guess you could do like the little Rascatos.
No, there's none of that. It's simply, it substitute the whole band, yeah.
Oh, so you just sit there, boom. You're using there's a lot of everything. Drone tones, a lot of the whole thing.
Yep. There's
ain't nothing wrong with that.
I mean, if it's a nice piece and if people enjoy it, I think. And if it's not...
Someone started cooking fish. You smell that?
I do, yeah.
Who's cooking fish? It's 1 p.m. What on earth is that?
It's your place.
I don't have any fish. I don't even fish. My girlfriend moved out a couple of weeks ago. There's like some oranges and a pizza box in the fridge. My place smells amazing. It's been nothing but takeout in this house for a while.
I'm just making sure you know how to edit, right?
I think so. I did press the button. I think it's the space bar to stop this at some point. But so you went to Ben and your favorite... I mean, Ben does... You know, when I talk to him on the show, he really wants his students. He does push his students to do something different and to find out who they are as an artist, not just as a guitarist.
You know, I have to say this. There was a drastic difference from undergrad to master's. And in my master's, I was much more free to explore. And it's kind of assumed that you know how to play the guitar by that point. And that's how it should be.
Yeah.
It wasn't just like, you know, oh, you have to do your scales, daily scales, and learn this and this and this and play it on the exam. It wasn't quite like that, which I kind of enjoyed. It allowed me to settle, like to kind of digest everything I've learned in the past. And
yeah, because you still, it's not like once you stop hearing that stuff, it stops affecting your playing. It's exactly the opposite. You know, I would think now I'm not doing it as much, but for the first 10 years after graduating from Texas, I thought about what Adam said almost every day.
Yep.
A new thing would come into my playing.
Yeah, definitely.
Whereas if you just do it every week, it's overload.
Yeah, to this day, I hear voices. Yeah, hear voices. At night.
Sometimes they're about guitar, sometimes they're about other things.
Sometimes they're just voices.
Right, you just have to get it checked
That's
out.
That's not good.
And then, so now you're in San Francisco.
Well, near, in Mountain View.
Are you a conservatory guy then eventually?
No. I never went to the conservatory.
What are you doing out there? That's where I'm from. I'm from Stockton.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, originally. 20 years ago.
Well, I'm teaching. I have a private studio there. I just started working at the Jewish Community Center, JCC.
Where?
In Palo Alto.
Oh, okay.
Which is right next to...
Well, I know the one in Marin County. I used to go see David Grisman there growing up. A mandolin player. So you're at the JCC in Palo Alto.
Yes. Well, my studio is in Los Altos, which is pretty much Mountain View.
Yeah.
Yeah, the JCC program is brand new, so they're just starting a new program and hoping to grow it. And the facilities are amazing. I think it's probably the best one in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So they have all kinds of after-school activities and performing arts school where I'm teaching guitar. And
is that what brought you out there?
No.
Right.
I was living in New York, and I found life in New York to be very, very stressful.
It is.
And it's very tough being a musician, especially a guitarist, I think, here.
Were you single here?
No, I wasn't single. I had a girlfriend from Yale.
But she's also a musician.
She was a guitarist.
Right. So it's a little too... Yeah, it's, well, it's just there's not a lot of money coming in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
if there's not enough money coming in, you got to go.
It was tough. I taught a little bit at the 92nd Street Y for a year. Mm-hmm. And I actually used to commute back to Connecticut because I established some private students.
Okay.
So a couple of days a week, once or twice a week, I would drive. I had a beat up Toyota Corolla.
Yeah.
And I would drive and teach. And it kind of got old quickly.
Yeah.
After 2 years, it was hard. So, and then we moved together to the Bay Area.
Just to just try it out?
Yeah, kind of. Well, her family is actually from there.
I mean, how was... Oh, okay. That's good. Okay, so she's from there.
Yeah.
Okay, I was just like, what? I don't know why I didn't put that together, but that would have been...
Yeah. And then basically, it got too stressful and it didn't work out between us. And I decided to stay there. I started to get some... traction there, some students, some performances, and decided to stay there. Yeah.
Well, good for you, man, because that's really tough. You know, I would imagine that there's a lot of graduates of the conservatory that you have to contend with, and that's always been an issue in New York City. Is that it's really tough for people to move here without going to school here and getting those connections first, because, you know, like, well, even if you study in Yale, that still counts as New York. You're able to maybe do the 92nd Street Y thing, but it's really tough to move into those big markets and not go and be part of their system and make a niche for yourself. Luckily, you're in Mountain View, which is a little bit further south.
You know, I have a constant demand for...
students.
Teaching.
Yeah. Oh, that's incredible. Yeah.
And
which is not the case in New York.
I don't think I can take any more students. It's just
great. How many days a week are you teaching then?
I have about 25 students privately, and then I also teach at that JCC.
Mm-hmm.
I think I have 2 days there, so it's a full load.
25 private.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Are they taking an hour each or a half?
No, mostly half hours.
Okay, but that's still a lot.
That's a lot. And I'm actually...
That's still 12 good hours of private. Are you going house to house like
no,
me?
No, I have a studio though.
Perfect, perfect.
It's in a beautiful location.
Buy a studio too. Like all this stuff you can't do in New York.
Well, rent.
Right. But at least it's a little office. Like you said, a beautiful location.
Yeah.
Man, all right, you're starting to make Northern California look good. I might have to move back there anyway.
Let's not talk about the weather.
Yeah, it's right. No rain. Well, anyway, Yuri, if there's anything else you want to talk about, what are you doing in New York City before we close up? I mean, this won't be on for a couple of, like, about 3 weeks, but you're doing a concert here or something?
I just drove from New Paltz.
Oh, okay.
I had first I flew into Baltimore. I played a concert in Baltimore.
I saw that, the Andy Music.
Uh-huh, Andy Music, yeah. Yep, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I played a concert in D.C., Washington, D.C., in an art gallery.
How was that Baltimore concert? I'm curious about it because I kind of submitted my stuff to them.
It wasn't very well attended, but sold more CDs than people came.
Wow.
Which was very unusual.
That's very unusual these days.
Yeah, my first time, and actually the owner of this place, he was surprised. He said that never happened. So whoever came, they were quite happy.
It's somebody, right? They really enjoyed themselves and bought a CD for everybody.
Yeah, and then I played in Washington D.C. and that concert was sold out.
I really like your CD cover, Yuri. It's beautiful.
Oh,
you're a great guitarist. You sound great. And thanks so much for coming on the show. And I hope that your little journey back here to the East Coast is going to be productive.
Thank you for having me. I wish we had more time, but
if there's anything else, do you have anything else you want to?
Anything else? Let's
I know
see.
It's a lot.
Yeah. Well, tonight I'm playing a concert in Brooklyn.
I know,
but
where are you playing tonight?
It's a place called Ezra Guitar. It's
Ezra Guitar. Yes.
Do you know where it is?
No, but I know that it's a special school that does special things. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
What is
they
it?
Have a stage. Like
outreach or?
No, no, they have, they teach guitar.
Oh, yeah.
But they also have a little stage. And
great, man.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I won't be there because I have to teach until 9. But I, you know, wish you the best. Enjoy your performance tonight, buddy.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming on, Yuri.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right, guys, this is Yuri playing music by Ernesto Lucuono, who he wrote this song. It's Danza Lucchini. All right, so that's what's going on. That's the best I can pronounce it. It is on something I can pronounce. That's the name of the CD, Ascension, Yuri's new CD. Next time, Victor Kalafidis is going to be on. He is a outstanding composer and mandolin player that I actually tried to get in my quartet in the early stages, and I love his music, and he's going to come on. We're going to talk about all sorts of things. I guess he started out playing guitar, so we've got a lot to talk about next time, and I hope you guys are doing good. Make sure you come to my show if you can. That's going to be this Friday at the Liederkranz Foundation on 6 East 87th Street. New York, New York, 11211. All right. 6 East 87th Street at 7 o'clock this Friday, December 4th. I'll see you guys there. Have a great week. Thank you.